Hello and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and this is Final Draft, books, writing, and literary culture coming to you every week. No matter what it takes, I am recording from social isolation, hidden under a special ironing board doona recording sort of situation. So please forgive any fluctuations in audio, because I do have some amazing books, as always, to share with you. Today, I have a debut novel. It is from Vivian Pham. It is called The Coconut Children, and I am so excited to be sharing this book. That is going to be coming up, and I will tell you a little bit more about that later. But of course, today I want to acknowledge and talk about the fact that the Stella Prize was announced on the 15th of April. Now, before we get going, I do want to acknowledge 2SER broadcasts from Broadway in Sydney. We record and broadcast on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I pay my respects to the traditional owners. Now, what a week in literature. It is a very, very difficult time for the arts. It is a very difficult time for literature. And it astounds me that so many people can still be so strong during this time. And one of the highlights of my year is always the Stella Prize. And it was announced via an incredible live, digitally telecast ceremony on Tuesday, the 15th of April, with Patricia Karvelas hosting, Julia Gillard giving a keynote address. And on that night, the top prize, it was announced. Before we get to that, it is always important to acknowledge how many people go into making up a prize like this. And the shortlisted authors were Tara June Winch for The Yield, Josephine Rowe for Here Until August, Caro Llewellyn for Diving Into Glass, Charlotte Wood for The Weekend, and Favel Parrott for There Was Still Love. But of course, that means that the winner for the 2020 Stella Prize was Jess Hill with See What You Made Me Do. Now, See What You Made Me Do is not a book that I guess we would typically cover on Final Draft, focusing on literature as we do. It is a work of investigation. Jess Hill is a journalist with, amongst other things, several Walkleys to her name. And See What You Made Me Do investigates domestic violence in Australia. It's the end result of 6 years of research on Jess Hill's part. And the book turns the spotlight of domestic violence onto the perpetrator, explores their actions and why men choose to commit violence. I am really excited to actually get a copy of this book and start reading it. But I have heard a little bit about it, and in her acceptance speech, Hill talked about the writing of See What You Made Me Do as a calling for her. Once she began, she knew it was something she had to do. And she explained that it was a book that needed to be written, that it took a personal toll on her to explore the subject, but that it is so important. It is an issue that is unresolved, that continues to affect so many Australians, and is just it's a blight on our culture and on us as a people. During her acceptance speech, Jess Hill also drew attention to the situation of the arts and of culture during the COVID-19 crisis, saying, "We are being kept sane by the work of artists, and yet still this government won't lift a finger to help them." So please do keep that in mind if you are enjoying a favourite book, if you are enjoying music, if you are enjoying shows. These are things that are created by Australian artists, or, you know, many of these things are created by Australian artists. So, you know, you can make simple decisions with your consumption. You can choose Australian artists. You can choose circumstances where you can pay so that the artist is actually receiving more money. You can avoid free ways of accessing, you know, by downloading and otherwise, to make sure that artists are getting their due. And you can also, you know, support the whole cultural industry. You know, for books, you can be ordering from independent bookstores and having them delivered. So many bookstores are still offering amazing deals for getting free delivery. So, look, congratulations to Jess Hill for winning the 2020 Stella Prize with See What You Made Me Do. And if you want to discover more about the Stella Prize, if you want to read and listen to Jess Hill's full acceptance speech, you can go to thestellaprize.com.au. It is something that I'm sure we will continue to hear about, and I'd love to speak about it more on the show. But, of course, today I have a brand new book by an incredible new Australian voice. Vivian Pham's The Coconut Children is, I mean, to read it and then realise that this is a debut novel written by a 20-year-old woman who had been writing the book since her teenage years is absolutely astounding. The Coconut Children explores two young people, one just having returned from juvenile detention, their lives growing up in Cabramatta in the late 1990s in Sydney. I cannot wait to share this. Vivian is such a wonderful writer. She's also a wonderful person to talk to. And so Vivian fans the Coconut Children. It's coming up on Final Draft. It's just going to be after this short break.
2SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. I am absolutely ecstatic to be sharing a fantastic new Australian novel today. From a distance, I am joined by Vivian Pham, and Vivian's bio describes her as a fiction writer, closet poet, amateur screenwriter, university student, and hopeful dropout if any of the aforementioned ventures take flight. That certainly seems to be the case to me, because Vivian's debut novel, The Coconut Children, is absolutely fantastic. And Vivian, I want to welcome you. Thank you so much for joining me on Final Draft.
Thank you for having me.
Now, taking us to Cabramatta in the late 90s, The Coconut Children sees Vince. He's returned to the streets of his youth. He's only 16. He's not yet old, but legendary after a two-year stint in juvenile detention. As the suburb and the schools struggle to contain Vince's vitality, Sonny can only watch on from afar. Sonny and Vince were childhood friends, but now Sonny is grappling with her own growing maturity and cannot fathom that the almost mythological figure of Vince might notice her as she watches from the window next door. So Vivian, there is so much to love and to discuss in The Coconut Children. I struggled to even begin. But when we meet Vince, there is something of a sort of a demigod being welcomed back to streets where he's notorious and legendary. And it strikes me that these tricks of memory occupy so much of and so many of the characters in The Coconut Children. So Sonny and Vince, they must each confront memory, their own and their parents, to make sense of their lives. What role do you see for the vicissitudes of memory in The Coconut Children?
Even the choice of setting it in the past and during a time that I wasn't born, like in 1998, and I was born 2 years later, even that choice, it was necessary because of the things that were happening in Cabramatta at that time. And when I was born in the 2000s, Cabramatta had really changed by that time, and there was a lot more intervention from the government and the police to change the conditions of the streets. But in the 90s, setting it in that time was for me like fictionalizing my relationship with, it felt like having, to me, it reflected how I have to imagine the connections that I have with my culture and with my family as well. I mean, like growing up, and hearing the stories that my parents would tell me about everything they had gone through to come to Australia, and made them seem mythical, like you said, in a way. And it made them seem like they were characters in a story that I had no part in. So, yeah, Sonny and Vince are both, like you said, they have to deal with the way the past, the role that the past has in their own lives.
I want to think a little bit more then about Sonny and Vince's relationship, but also the relationship you just mentioned, because memory, it connects Sonny and Vince to the struggles of their parents in migrating to Australia as refugees. And there's a scene where Vince and his friends are singing karaoke, and Vince has just listened to one of his mates. I think I'm pretty sure it was Tim Tam.
It was Tim Tam.
And Vince wonders, how could somebody grieve with an honesty that seemed to bleed, a love that was never his, a love that he'd never known, a memory he could never remember? And it felt to me like you were asking what obligation the present owes to the past. And that seems like a really important question for us all.
It is. And I feel like one of the reasons it's so, it was and is still so painful is because it just feels so intangible and records of the past that we have that kind of preserve our relationship to the people that we know and their experiences and everything they'd gone through. It just feels so like it will vanish if you don't remember it. And I feel like a lot of the children, certain, like I do as well, we feel a responsibility to remember just so that we can lift any burden that we can from our parents.
Yeah, there's another scene where Sunny has gone to the library after school, and I think she prefaces it with this idea that she needs another type of learning, and she's going through old newspaper articles and looking at absolutely horrific stories of Vietnamese refugees trying to come to Australia in the late 70s, the early 80s. Mm. And there's a word that you actually use, and if I'm remembering this correctly, because I didn't make a note of it, silly me, but she talks about the newsprint being decaying, which is, it seems like a far more appropriate word for the visceral story that she's reading rather than the paper in her hands. But that's obviously a product of her remembering.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the phrase was like so black and white, so gray and decaying, because it just feels like it's so stark, and yet it feels like it's just made its way into her memory and it's already fading. It already feels so difficult to grasp. But I also want to say that scene for me was really hard to write and quite autobiographical, because during the HSC, when I was writing a lot and trying to figure out, trying to just remember all these like traumatic histories of Vietnamese refugees from that time, I was also, those are just like two or three pages. And then immediately after that scene of her in the library, the next day she's watching Vince and like salivating over him as he plays basketball. So it's just like these things, these memories can really impact us and mean a lot to us in a specific moment, and then we can completely forget about them. And it's just, it feels so fickle at times, and your relationship with these histories feels so just hard to rely on and undependable.
Before we leave memory alone, though, I wanted to also think about the way memory works in character as well as in place. You've already mentioned that you've set the book at a time in Sydney and Cabramatta's history before you were born, a time that's very different to if someone were to, well, nobody should be driving to Cabramatta or anywhere right now because we're all practicing social isolation. But, if you were to go to Cabramatta now, it would look very different to the scene 22 years ago.
It would.
Yeah, it's felt to me like Sunny and Vince, as they travel through Cabramatta, they're seemingly trying to come to terms with the world that they feel they occupy, a very contemporary, I guess, Australian world, and a world far away that's evoked by the adults around them, the stores that they see. How did you imagine these perspectives and also this space some 20 years later? How did you actually physically create that for yourself?
So I feel like, growing up, I've never lived in Cabra. I lived in like surrounding suburbs, and my family, like a lot of Vietnamese families, would go to Cabra every weekend to do our grocery shopping. And even growing up, I always felt like this sense of nostalgia, because it was so different to me from the things that I'd seen on TV and the movies I'd watched and the books I'd read. I'd never seen a place like this depicted before, and I feel like now it's changing. There are lots of people wanting to hold a mirror up to their own communities and have a place for their communities in literature and in arts. But yeah, growing up, I just felt like I felt already nostalgic for a place that was still there, and I didn't have a strong connection to Vietnam. I'd only traveled back and forth a few times as a kid. So Cabra to me was like my portal to Vietnam, and it wasn't just my relationship to my parents' country. It was also I'd heard stories growing up about what Cabra used to be like, and I'd had relatives that were growing up around that area during that time that a lot of kids were getting in trouble. And so I'd always heard about, like, even up until, like, very recently, none of us, when we'd go to Cabra, if we'd need to, like, go to the toilet, we'd have to wait till we go home, because my parents were still afraid of, needles in the bathroom and stuff. So I always grew up with this image of Cabra, and by the time I was growing up, it was already safe for families to go freely. But that idea of what it used to be like, and that's kind of also that it mirrors the way that my parents remember Vietnam and the way that it used to be like, and the Vietnam that they grew up in is really different to the one that I'd seen and visited. So yeah, it's just this idea of trying to remember something that your parents had lived, or that people before you had contact with, and that you don't really have any connection to but through their memories.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, Books, Writing and Literary Culture. Now, my name is Andrew Popel, and right there, that was Vivian Pham. Vivian and I are discussing her debut novel. It is called The Coconut Children. The narrative takes us back to Cabramatta in the late 1990s, and Vivian's incredible exploration and coming-of-age story set in that suburb, and really looking at diaspora experiences of Vietnamese refugees as well as their children. Now, there is more of that conversation to come. So if you want to hear more from Vivian, please stay tuned. But I want to share a little bit of music with you. And really, I think one of the things that I want to be doing with Final Draft while we are all in social isolation is helping you discover amazing Australian artists. Now, I try and do that every week with authors, but I also have a great chance with musicians. So I'm going to play a track. This is from a Melbourne songwriter. Her name is Hannah Cameron, and the track I'm going to share is Backsliding. Now, if you love this track, if you want to check out more, Hannah does have a Bandcamp. So many Australian artists, independent artists, will have a Bandcamp where you can buy their singles. So that is a great way to support Australian arts while we're in social isolation and we can't be going out to shows and checking out artists in other ways. But without any further ado, this is Hannah Cameron with Backsliding.
What is
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3, and I am Andrew Popel. Right there, that was a track from Melbourne songwriter Hannah Cameron. The track was called Backsliding, and if you loved that track, you can check out Hannah's Bandcamp, where you can buy that track amongst some of her other music. It is a great way to support artists and just get more of the art that you love. Of course, you can always stay tuned listening to 2SER 107.3, but like, get out and support Aussie artists, including today's novelist. I am speaking with Vivian Pham. We're going to get back to discussing her book, The Coconut Children, and I'm particularly interested in exploring with Vivian her depictions of masculinity and the way they play through the novel.
I was enthralled by your evocation of sort of these contradictory performances of masculinity in The Coconut Children. Now, we've got Vince and his group of friends. We've got Alex, Danny, Tim Tam. They're ostensibly a gang. Like, you show them basically kind of, in some ways, good-natured terror that they perform, like egging the girls' school. Which, I mean, I think we can examine that from different perspectives. But they want to present a veneer of toughness. But then it's also too often betrayed by a real sweetness and caring. The scene that I mentioned of Tim Tam singing, Danny trying to win teddies on a claw machine for his many girlfriends. We also see this in the contrasting figures of Vince's father and Sonny's dad. Now, performing masculinity is not particularly a way that we would have talked about or viewed these characters in the late 90s. But what were you trying to understand in these various ways of being?
What was I trying to understand? Well, Vince is based on one of my relatives and someone I know and love very much. And I guess I wasn't thinking about, at the time, I wasn't really thinking about the big questions of what it means to want to be a man, and how boys learn how to become men from each other and from their fathers. I was thinking just about his life, my relative's life in particular, and the way that he carries himself, and the way that a lot of other boys would try to, the dynamics that they created for themselves, and the ways that they interacted with each other, and the closeness, but also the closeness that they had with each other, but also the distance of not wanting to be someone that the other wouldn't respect and wouldn't. Yeah, I don't know. It's a tough question because I didn't really think about it that much. I really just wanted to have a group of friends.
They're an extraordinary group of friends. So, I mean, I'm struck by, to put this in context for the readers, Vince, for the listeners, Vince has, you know, just left 2 years in juvenile detention, and his friends immediately enclose around him. They give him a home, they take him shopping, they buy him clothes, and create this sort of nurturing environment. And at the same time, they take him out, they take him clubbing. There are moments where, early in the book, where they want him to come out and be drinking with them, and he's kind of saying no. It's not something that he wants because he hasn't drank for 2 years and he's got a hangover from the night before, and they're doing that sort of good-natured but kind of often quite harmful ribbing that men do to men about
your memory
drinking.
Is immaculate. Like, whoa. How you get all these details. But yeah, it's just a constant like resistance and also surrender and resistance of who he is and what he wants to do, and also who his friends think he is and how he's performed himself to them.
Yeah, I think my memory is so alive to this because in a way you're describing, I think, something that most men will have experienced. Like I've been in positions where I feel like I've wanted to say, no, I don't want to drink. I don't want another drink. And I've probably also been in the opposite position of the friends going, come on, you've got to have a drink. You're not part of the group if you don't. And then just the sweetness, the caring, the sensitivity, that was what really got me, because it is this amazing situation where it is something I think that most men feel, but not many have that supportive environment that you have created with Vince and his friends.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for telling me that. That makes me feel so much better.
It's really interesting though then to look at Vince's father, whom he has a very strained relationship with, his father has problems with alcohol, and that's led to problems in the home. His dad's abusive. And then Sonny's dad, who at one stage when Vince goes round, is very kind of fatherly and matey with Vince, but Vince has a lot of trouble settling into that environment that feels so nurturing. And again, just these two different styles of masculinity create it's really interesting to think about it as I read about it.
Yeah, his relationship with Sonny's dad is interesting because he isn't used to being around older men that have like a stable or proper job. He isn't used to being around, in Vietnamese culture, you'd call Sonny's dad an educated and like a civilized man. And the men that he's been around growing up don't mirror that at all, especially his own dad. And I feel like he has a lot of respect for Sonny's dad, but he also feels like he'll never be able to settle in that kind of life where he's a man and he's a hardworking man and he comes home every day to a family.
And if you'd like to engage more in those essential questions that Vivian is discussing, I am talking to Vivian Pham. We are discussing her new novel, her debut novel, The Coconut Children. It is absolutely terrific. And I like, wherever you are, there are so many bookstores that will deliver to your door. So get yourself a copy of The Coconut Children. Vivian, thank you so much for taking the time for Final Draft.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
You are on 2SER 107.3. Now, my name is Andrew Popel, and you have been listening to Final Draft. I have you for but a few minutes longer. Thank you so much for joining me again, as every week. It is great to be able to talk books, writing, and literary culture with you. Huge thank you also to Vivian Pham. Vivian joined me over Skype, and in this time of social isolation, it is incredible to still be able to have these conversations. Please excuse any indifferent audio when it happens. It can be tricky recording in social isolation, but Vivian's debut novel is The Coconut Children. It is available right now, wherever you are in Australia. If you are joining us online or if you're listening back on the podcast, you can get that. Check out your local booksellers, independent booksellers. Many of them have delivery options, and it'll keep you entertained. Support amazing Australian artists while you are in social isolation. It's almost time for me to say goodbye. I really don't have much time left, but I want to remind you that if you've missed anything, if you want to check out more great Australian authors, the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast is there for you. Every week we put up a new Australian author discussing their work. So you've got some 100-odd episodes you can go back and rediscover and get some insight into their books. Of course, there is more amazing stuff going on at 2SER over the day. So stay tuned, listen to the music, the stories, the ideas. But for me, I am Andrew Popel. It is time to say goodbye. I will be back next week with more great books, writing, and literary culture. As always, I'm going to give you my standard goodbye, which is happy reading, and bye for now.